Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Straight Talk. I am your host, Ted Santos, and I come to you live every Sunday, 7 p.m., and we are the talk show made for men, by men, except ladies, you will never want to miss our show, and this Sunday will be no different. You'll want to hear this. We'll be talking about money. We are the show that talks about relationships. How do you make relationships better? And we look at it from a man's perspective. We live in a country that is filled with battle of the sexes. Well, we want to bridge that gap. I just don't see why men and women would be in a battle anyway. There's nothing in nature. Even the black widow spider waits until after mating before she kills her or the male. So the battle doesn't come until it's not even a battle, after consummation. So we like to take on topics that are considered provocative, and we take on a perspective that's not normal or ordinary. You could even say not politically correct. And we'd like to talk about money this time, and we'd like to look at it from a very different perspective. Most people talk to you about how to manage your money more efficiently, how to save, how to go up to the next, you know, from middle class, and you incrementally do these things. So no one really talks in great detail about wealth-building strategies of the affluent. And we hear about all the diversification. So today, I want to really take on wealth-building strategies. You know, we've talked about generational wealth and looking several generations down the line and how you're setting them up. So whether you're middle class or you're already affluent, I'd like to talk about what are the very specific strategies that affluent families and even families, very wealthy families like the Rockefellers, there are things that they do that you may or may not be aware of. So we invite you to call in and engage us. I'm not going to do this one by myself. I actually have someone who has mastery over the universe of wealth building. His name is Perry Jeffries, and I'm going to introduce him to you in a second. If you would like to call in, our call-in number is 323-642-1387. That's 323-642-1387. And as always, we like to do our show as more of a roundtable forum, so we always have several people on the line, and we all engage in a topic. Some of you may have experience already in generating wealth. We'd like to hear your strategies and engage Perry in this conversation about wealth building. Do you know the wealth building strategies of the affluent? So we're going to stay very focused on this, and we're going to look at it from a number of different perspectives. So before Perry and I start engaging this, why don't I let you get to know him a bit? First of all, Perry, let them know you're here in the house. Say hello to everyone.
I'm in the building. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You break up a little bit, but I can hear you.
Outstanding. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, great. Pleasure to have you. So let me tell them about you, and then I'll ask you a couple of questions. You and I have spoken. Some of you may already know Perry was on our show several months ago, and he talked about being physically fit, and he talked about a number of strategies that people can do to increase their financial fitness in their life. So this time we're looking at taking it to the next several levels and talking about, you know, once you're physically fit, what do you do when you're affluent? And we'll also talk about the mindset that is absolutely critical if you're going to function in an affluent manner. If you're going to manage your money, your resources, generational wealth, there's a very, very specific mindset that's distinct from people who do not manage affluence. And Perry, I can hear some shuffling and things moving around in the background on your side.
Hold on one second here. I'm going to see if I can switch my mic. Hold on one second for me.
Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about Perry.
All right, can you
Perry
hear me okay?
Is the president. Oh, yeah, I can still hear you. Yep. So I'm going to tell them a little about you. Perry is the president of Diamond Equity Advisors, a full-service business consulting and financial planning firm. It's located in Columbus, Ohio. And while he lives there, he works with clients across the country. As a fractional CFO who works with 6 to 7-figure entrepreneurs, Perry pulls back the layers to show their true financial health. Working directly with entrepreneurs who look good on paper, but in reality are drowning in financial overwhelming debt and business liabilities. I mean, that must be shocking for people to see that. He's known as the Entrepreneur CFO. Perry offers business owners access to membership into his exclusive PASS program. That's PASS, P-A-S-S. And it stands for Profit Accelerator Small Business System. The PASS program drives double-digit profits while decreasing expenses and increasing cash flow. So let me tell you, what else can we tell you about him? He attended Central Howard High School in Akron, Ohio. After graduation, he played for the coaching legend Bill Van Gundy at Genesee Community College, where he became an all-region awardee and runner-up for Player of the Year in the conference. He then earned a full division athletic scholarship to Tennessee State University, where he completed his formal education, earned a degree in mathematics and a minor in biology. That's quite a combination. But usually mathematics people have to be pretty damn smart. They talk about majors where you have to have what you call high intelligence or high IQ. Math and physics are two of them where it's necessary. Just a little bit more. As a financial industry veteran of 16 years, Perry has held positions with Fortune 500 companies and was instrumental in launching a pilot program which brought in $1 billion worth of investment assets to the firm. Wow, that's huge. Perry is currently being featured on Fox 28 Columbus, Ohio in segment Financially Fit Fridays with Perry, where he provides entertaining yet thought-provoking content to individuals and businesses on a weekly basis. In the areas of finance, Perry currently holds a Series 7 license, which is a securities trading equities, Series 66, that's investment advisor, life health, annuity licenses, has a CRPC, so you're one of those guys who has all those acronyms after your name. CRPC, CRPC, for those who haven't heard it, is a chartered retirement planning counselor, designation through college financial planning, and has a CPFA, which is a certified plan fiduciary advisor. In addition, he owns one of the few firms across the globe that holds the Certified Profit First Professional Certification, specializing in business cash management and profitability. He's also a member, and this is interesting, Perry's also a member of the John Maxwell Global Leadership Team, where he earned the certification of speaker and coach. So you have, you're definitely a numbers guy, right? You have a scientific approach with biology. So numbers, accounting, and then you have this coaching, which deals with the mindset. You know, there are lots of people who are good at numbers, and we talked about it, I think, in our last show, how there are people who win a lottery, yet they win $10 million, and they're worse off a few years down the line because they spent more than they won. They didn't pay taxes, and You know, they were not good at numbers. And if, even if they were good at numbers, they didn't have a mindset to manage that kind of windfall of money and ended up squandering it. So you have a very impressive background. So you're a high-performance athlete, mathematics, not the normal combination of a math major and a athletic, you know, high performing athlete, and you're getting great exposure in the media. So thank you for joining us. An impressive background.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. So you've been on the show before, and you and I chatted about this one to prepare for the show. So tell everyone about, just to get started, so you're not a CPA, so people often look at that, except you have clear mastery over numbers. So what's the difference between you and a CPA and you're a financial planner? So what difference does that make? Should that matter to anyone who looks to hire you?
Oh, it should, and because whenever you're hiring your team, your financial team, you should really be crystal clear on what their expertise is. And it's one of the reasons we've removed ourselves from the title of financial advisor, because it's so confusing to everybody, because what does financial advisor mean, right? There's so many individuals who claim to be financial advisors, but what licenses do they have? What are their experiences? What's their expertise? Space and how I'm different from a CPA. A CPA is a certified public accountant. So that is an individual who has mastery over taxes. And typically you have with your CPAs, they're very reactional but with respects to how they do their business. So you go to your CPA, you give them your tax documents, they come back to you and they say, okay, this is what you owe in taxes and this is how you can make your payments and so forth and so on. Every once in a while you have some CPAs who are proactive and may give you some recommendations on the front end on how you can reduce your taxes. But a CPA is someone who has mastery over tax accounting, whereas my space as an advisor and a coach, my mastery over business financials and also to, personal wealth building. So my expertise is in investments, cash flow, retirement planning, things of that nature. So that's the difference between the two. So quite frankly, my clients who do the best and have the most success, their advisor, i.e. somebody like me, works closely with their CPA, because we do two different jobs. But if you were to put your board of directors together, you want to make sure those two individuals are working closely with each other. So that's the difference between the two.
Interesting. So that's why, let's say, in an organization large enough, they would separate finance and accounting. So accounting is...
Mm-hmm.
giving a report on what's already happened, and your finance, especially your CFO, your chief financial officer, that person is more strategic and proactive in how to move the organization forward. So you are a, and I know you didn't say this, you're like a rent a CFO for entrepreneurs, correct?
That's exactly what I am. You hit the nail on the head. That's it.
Right. So you help people. You help people strategically put together, and that can be quite complicated. And even the president or CEO of a company, the founder of an organization, could be really brilliant at what they do and even be good at numbers, except the way you marry finance with operations and future projections can be quite detailed. And someone who is really good at operations and inventing things for a company may not be able to see all the things that you see financially and map it out strategically.
Absolutely correct. And just to even piggyback on that a little bit, if you think about it, you know, if you have a CEO of a company, they're the visionary of the company. They're the ones who have the vision of where they want to take the company. And to your point, that individual may be really good at numbers, but at the end of the day, have blind spots. So that's where a CFO comes into an organization, is to help add clarity on the numbers that are coming from the accounting and from the other areas, and to put those numbers in front of the CEO, hey, our numbers, this is strategically what we need to do to impact the bottom line and increase profitability. So you can have a CEO who's a numbers whiz, but they're still going to hire a CFO just to make sure they're covering their behind and make sure they have somebody that can identify those blind spots that they may have.
Absolutely. And usually the CFO is the right-hand man of the CEO.
Exactly.
Even in the large Fortune 100 companies, that's his right-hand
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm. So, exactly. Absolutely.
So today we want to talk about forecasting. It's sort of like you being a CFO for people in general on this call who are looking to create wealth, who are looking to add revenue. If you look at a household as an organization,
mm-hmm.
You know, you have a two-parent household, you have children, people have, whether they have jobs or even more so, they're entrepreneurs, the parents are entrepreneurs. It's not only income for the parents who want a lifestyle for a house and clothes and, you know, sending their children to great schools and cars and all those things, but they really need to be forward-looking to how they set their children up. And not only are their children set up, are their grandchildren and great-grandchildren going to be set up? You know, you hear so much about the third generation squanders the wealth of the ones who started it. And so how do you really infuse, I want to say, the not just money into their lifestyle, there's a mindset that will be needed so they don't squander it and they continue the legacy that the original parents who built the affluence. So you kind of help people move in that direction so that they can have affluence, that they have their children who are well off, and they can strategically manage money, and all the, there are many tools and instruments. So you and I are going to talk about some of those tools, but we also want to talk about how some people may not have started out with the greatest advantage. So there are a few things that we're going to have to address, right? Like, so post-Civil War, we're looking at here in the U.S., we're not going to really be talking about what's happening in Africa or Europe or Brazil. We're going to be talking about right here in the U.S. and wealth-building strategies. So Freedman's Bank, entrepreneurship, we're going to talk about life insurance. And maybe it's the smallest part, investing. And in part of investing, I'd like to get your thoughts on Bitcoin or this electronic currency. Like, what kind of thoughts? Maybe we can actually start. Well, we'll start where you want. We can talk post-Civil War, and I'd like to at some point get your thoughts on Bitcoin. But post-Civil War, some people didn't start out with the greatest advantage after the Civil War. Countries kind of torn apart. Land and being a merchant. Whether selling tobacco or furs after the Civil War, those are ways that people, but land was the number one. I read a book, and I can't remember the full name. It was like Financial History of the United States from 1600 until like 1934, and it talked about how in the 1600s, the way people had created wealth in the U.S. was they literally had land. Like some guy at some point went out to California. This wasn't 1600, but he went out to California and said, from this rock to there and from here to the beach is my land. And that place we now know as Los Angeles. Los Angeles belonged to a family. In New York, we had a guy, John Astor, who owned a significant part of Manhattan and other places. So there are lots of people who created wealth, and they were just taking land, basically, like taking candy from a baby. But after the Civil War, so I'll share something quick, Perry. I think you and I talked about it. So land is important. So during World War II, there's a Pacific island, and I forget which one, where the United States military needed land on this island. And they asked the islanders, hey, can we use your land during the war? We'll give it back to you when it's over. And these people were living off the land. I mean, they didn't really need jobs. They had their own form of trade and commerce between one another. They grew everything they needed, or they bartered. And when the U.S. took their land just for the war, the United States never gave it back. So now these people are in poverty because they can't live off the land the way they know how to live. They have to go get jobs, and on their island there aren't many jobs, so now they're depending on government assistance. They have to buy things from a store where they could have made it themselves, and it created an enormous amount of poverty on that island. So the same thing happened here. There are lots of people here in the U.S., especially when we look at Black Americans. There were many who were already here before the European settlers arrived here, and some of them, the same strategy as the Pacific Islanders, the U.S. military during the Civil War asked, could we use your land? And they never gave it back. So that created, as you can imagine, the same kind of poverty. Instead of living off the land and being self-sufficient, they now had to go work for someone else and work for low wages and much more difficult to create wealth. And as I was saying, land was a major way that wealth was created in the U.S. So I think you had some thoughts about this also.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So let me set the expectation like this. We're having a conversation about wealth building, wealth creation. You said some things here in your intro. I think it's extremely powerful, and I don't know if the listeners caught it. So I'm going to bring some things up here. But before we move forward in the conversation, you said some things hey, we're going to discuss the strategies of the affluent, because typically in our community we're discussing the strategies of how to, you know, get to the middle class, and then what do you do to get, you know what I'm saying, to move and progress from the middle class. What I think we really need to get our heads wrapped around is this. Why start there? Why not start with the end in mind? So if you and I'm in a room, Ted, and it doesn't matter if I'm in a room of five people or in the rooms I've been in, I've had 200 plus. I asked the room, I said, who wants to be wealthy? Everybody's hands goes up, right? Every hand in the room goes up without fail. And then I ask, so how do you define wealth? And every hand goes down, and you can almost drop a pen. And so if we can't define wealth, you have a way to measure it, how in the world can you put a plan together to achieve it? So it's hard in our community to have that wealth building conversation because we don't even know how to define it. And that's just not limited to our people as far as Black people. You know, I'll have clients from almost every nationality you can think of. That's across the board. So, and we're just kind of against the eight ball because of some things that we'll cover in our talk. So this is how I start my meetings off. Who wants to be wealthy? Every hand in the room goes up. My next question is, how do you define wealth? So before we get into some of the meat and potatoes of what we're going to talk about, I say that to the viewers, like, okay, the listeners, I should say, how do you define wealth? Well, how we define it, or how we quote measure it with our clients, we say this: if you were to stop doing whatever it is you are doing today at this point in time to earn money, but if you were to stop doing whatever you're doing at this point in time to earn money, how long, based on time, would you be able to maintain your quality of life before you ran out of money? So could you do that for 10 years? So if you're not working today, could you maintain your quality of life for 10 years with the resources that you have? So with the income you have, income, residual income have come in, with investments, with your retirement plan, with your rental income, whatever the case may be, how long would that? Would it be 10 years? Would it be, you know, a year? Would it be 30 days? I'm going to have one person say to me one time, like, hey, Pierre, I got about 24 hours. If my direct deposit doesn't hit, things are going to fall off. So how do we define wealth? Yeah. So if you think about wealth, let's measure it first. How do you define it? Well, we measure it in time. So now that we've done that and we say, okay, wow, how long would I maintain my quality of life? Then we reverse engineer and say, well, how much money do I need to live off? And is that, you know, $5,000 a month? Is that $10,000 a month? Doesn't matter. But if you reverse engineer into that number and you know that you need $5,000 a month off of to maintain your quality of life, that's $60,000 a year. Okay, so now we have a target number to hit. Well, how much in assets do we need to be able to generate that type of income or passive income to maintain our quality of life? And that's where we start with the wealth creation conversation. And a lot of times we're trying to start off with the, hey, let's put away $50 a month or $100 a month. We're not going to close the gap with wealth. We actually need to start understanding how wealthy people create wealth, how they created it, what their mindset was, and then there's nothing new underneath the sun. Let's take what they do, reverse engineer into our personal situation, and now we can move the needle. But we have to take the time to understand that first.
Really good. I remember reading a book, and it said, rich people, they said the difference between being rich and being wealthy is that rich people have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Wealthy people have a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
I love that.
Rich people, they have money, and as long as they work, they will continue to have money. Wealthy people, they just have time. They don't have to. They have so much money that they don't have to work.
That's it.
They have time.
And that's
they have money.
That's
so
right.
They don't run out in 24 hours or 10 years. They have time.
Mm-hmm. So if that's our goal, well, let's back into that number. So I'll share this with you, and we can kind of get into some of the meat and potatoes here, but this is honestly God's truth. So I've had a client who at one point in time had about $1 million with him. He had $997,000 when we started working with each other. And, you know, for intents and purposes, I mean, he's a millionaire. And you think, like, man, somebody with $1 million, they made it. They don't have to worry about a thing. Well, he had, you know, just shy of $1 million with me, but he was spending $10,000 a month. So he's spending $100,000 a year. Well,
right.
If you're spending $120,000 a year, how long does $1 million last? You're talking at best seven, eight years. And don't let the market correct.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It might be 5 to 6, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right.
I've also had clients who, a couple here locally with me, who had combined together $250,000. Now, this is not a couple you would look at on the surface and be like, oh, they're wealthy. I mean, they got $250,000 between the both of them. But what you didn't know when we lift up and looked underneath the hood, they had income coming in from several pension plans. We had Social Security coming in. We had, like I said, pension plans from different couple of companies we worked with. We had rental income coming in. All of their debts were paid off. They had no mortgage, had no car notes, right? That couple never had to touch their $250,000. So if we understand how to measure wealth, that couple, only $250,000 between them, was wealthier than the guy who had $1 million. So wealth is it's not about, oh, how big a nest egg. It's about your assets and your cash flow. So and with that being said, now the question probably lies is how do we now think about building wealth? Well, one, we got to measure it. Before we can even have a conversation, we need to measure what wealth is for you, because wealth is different for everybody. What's wealth for me, and I guess what's going to give me the most time freedom with my family, is going to be different from maybe you, Ted, or from one of our listeners, right? But we need to identify what that is for us. And then now we can start moving the needle, because we got to know where to start before we know where we need to go. So, and then from there, and we can set the thing for the rest of our conversation this way, is let's talk about ownership. Right, because I've worked with several multimillionaires, have a very, very close friend who's worth almost, well, he's worth trying to get to be worth $1 billion, worth about, I think, $180 million right now. And we had a conversation. And at the end of the day, wealth is derived from some type of ownership. I'll say, right. Wealth is derived from some type of ownership. We have to get our heads wrapped around that if we're going to close this gap on wealth, that we have to start thinking about what we can own. And what I loved about your segment, you're right, if I was reading it, you referenced a couple people here, Warren Buffett, you referenced the Rockefellers, you referenced Jeff Bezos with Amazon. And these are all very different people in different industries. You got the Rockefellers in oil, you got Jeff with Amazon, you got Warren Buffett with stocks. But if the more common denominator in all three of those, you know, saying some of the richest people in the world is this, they all own something. Warren Buffett owns companies because he's a stock investor. So when you own stock, you have ownership of a company. And he just happens to go in and purchases 50-60% of the companies that he likes. So he's a owner. The Rockefellers owned an oil magnet, right? They were they owned that industry, right? And you and
Standard,
I into the stock.
Standard yep. Oil.
Standard Oil, absolutely. That's what they owned, right? And then the way they've been able to keep that wealth moving forward is their ownership in insurance products and things that generate cash flow. And then
right, exactly.
And Jeff, he owned what? Jeff started owning a bookstore ownership. Amazon started off as a bookstore, an online bookstore, and look at where it is right now. So the one common denominator with those three is ownership. And that's where we move the needle with wealth. So we have to get out of the consumer mindset and get to the owner mindset. So from there, my friend, where do you want to take the conversation?
Well, so property is one way to own, right? So what do you think is the simplest thing for people to own? And I'm asking you to think in terms of generational wealth. So what's the simplest number one thing that a person could own that could be valuable and add to their wealth as well as future generations?
So great question. And my answer is not going to be what our listeners are expecting. It might surprise you too. The one thing that can move the needle to get us closer to wealth that all of us can own, and it's very simple, is our skills. Own your skills, because that's something no one can ever take away from you. It's something that can generate income. It's something you can pass down to generations, and you can create wealth. So let's segue a little bit, and I know I mentioned this with you in some of our previous conversations. Let's talk about that post-Civil War area. So everybody here who's listening to this, please find this PBS special. I don't know where you can find it now. You might have to even order it now. But there was a documentary that came out this year. It was called Boss, B-O-S-S. And it was Boss, The Black Experience in Business. And I watched this piece, and it was mind-blowing to me, especially with me being in the financial service industry, because what it did for me was it gave me crystal clarity on why we are so far behind in this wealth game. And for those who don't know how far behind we are, there's a stat out there that you can look up in Google, I believe, by saying the projection is by 2053, the average net worth for Black Americans will be zero. Let me say that again. By 2053, the average net worth for Americans, Black Americans, will be zero. Now, let that sink in for a second, because we're making money. And to your point, Ted, is the difference between being rich and wealthy. We're making money. We're closing the income gap. There's a lot of us out here making really good coin. But what are we doing with that money? And are we functioning from the standpoint of, hey, we're looking to create wealth? So I say that, and let me kind of go back and give you guys a little backstory on this this documentary. So it starts off post-Civil War era, and it was mind-blowing to me. So the first thing, think about like this. Right before the slaves were emancipated in the South, they were the individuals who were doing what? They were the ones doing the tilling of land. They were the farmers. Right. They were the craftsmen. They were the barbers. They were the cooks. They did everything, right? That was the whole purpose of having slaves. They did all the work. So when they were emancipated, these slaves automatically became entrepreneurs. Because what did they go do? They started barber shops. They did the sharecropping piece, right? They went into tailoring. They went in, they became cooks. So they took the same skill set that they had mastered through slavery and became entrepreneurs. So right immediately post-slavery, it was a huge boom in Black entrepreneurship. So we were, we are just positioned to create wealth, because wealth is one of the fastest ways to, entrepreneurship is one of the fastest ways to create wealth. Well, immediately post-slavery, that's what we went into. That was our skill set. Well, what a lot of us don't know is during that that window post-slavery, there was a bank was established, because now you have these black entrepreneurs making money, because now they're getting paid for the same thing that they weren't getting paid for during slavery. Now they're getting paid for it. Well, what do these individuals now do with the money? Well, the government created a bank called Freedmen's Bank. And Freedmen's Bank, as blacks, we couldn't put money in the banks. So they created a bank for the freedmen, the free black men and women. Well, we start loading this bank with deposits. They were telling us, hey, this is what you need to do. Put your money in the bank. Get interest on it, right? So we don't know anybody. This is what we're doing. Well, the Freedmen's Bank, as money was going into it, these individual black folks were putting money into it. Well, what happened when they went to take their money out? So we had a racist chairman over Freedmen's Bank, and he was doing was taking the deposits, which in today's dollars would be close to $1 trillion. So this right here, Ted, is one of the largest white collar crimes that never had anybody ever prosecuted for it. So in today's dollars, we put in billions, yet almost close to trillions of dollars in today's dollars. And the chairman of this bank was taking the money out of taking our deposits that were coming in, and then putting the money out to his people. Well, when we start, the U.S. having some issues, you know what I'm saying, and we start to go in and say, hey, we need to take some of our money out. It was no money there. So the government then brought in Frederick Douglass to fix this situation. Like, okay, we got to bring in somebody to help this situation. And when he got there and looked at the bank deposits, he said, there's no way, there's nothing I can do. The lifeblood of a bank is cash, and there's no money here. Well, let that sink in for a second. We're already entrepreneurs. We're actually making money. We're doing what we're supposed to be doing. We're putting money to the financial system so that we can create wealth and savings and things of that nature. When we go to get our money, it's gone. Now we're destitute, right? Well, what do the fathers and the mothers tell their children when they're like, mom and dad, we can't eat. We're losing everything. We're losing our homes. We're losing our real estate. What do you tell them? Well, you tell them, hey, the bank stole our money. Well, what happens when that's passed down from generation to generation? We now have an immediate mistrust of financial institutions. Well, else are you supposed to return your money if you're not, getting interest on it from the bank, or you're not invested in the stock? So even today in 2019, I still have folks, black folks say to me, well, I'm kind of nervous. I don't want you to take my money. And you know what? And at first, you just think like, oh, well, you watch it too much TV. And no, that's because the first round of entrepreneurs post-slavery era experienced all of their money being taken away, and it's been passed down from century to century. So that's one of the things right there, right? But understand this, going back to the wealth building. The first you can own is your skill set. What is it that you can do to generate revenue? And that's what we were doing before our monies were taken away. So kind of your thoughts on that, Ted, and I can kind of move on to another part, but I don't want to do all the talking. You have some
breath. You're fine.
Okay.
That's an amazing story. So you basically, an entire community is robbed. That's a lot of money. So for those who were entrepreneurs and put their money in the bank, as we all know, when your company is growing, at some point you need cash for expansion. As a finance guy, you know, you want to bring on a new employee, you need cash flow. You need to be able to pay this person. Or as you hear cases where the founders, they don't take a paycheck. And they sacrifice themselves to pay. Well, once your money's gone, that makes expansion very, very difficult. For one or two, because many people, entrepreneurs, go to the bank for a loan to bridge, you know, kind of bridge. So you don't have your own money. The bank has no money to loan you. So you're in negative, basically, at that point.
You're in negative. So if we own real estate, you know what I'm saying, for you of us that did own real estate, or you owned a farm, or you had to share a cropping relationship on, or whatever the case may be, well, if you don't have money during the dry spells, you have a dry season, or you need to purchase crops, or whatever the case may be, but all your cash is gone. Cash, lifeblood to wealth, right? Well, if there's no cash, well, now you lose homes. Now you lose farms. I saw a stat not too long ago. Oh, I read an article not too long ago talking about all the millions of dollars that were lost when Black families had their farms foreclosed on because they couldn't keep them low. Because, again, we have the skill set.
That's devastating.
We have the skill set. So we knew how to farm. And we knew how to build the buildings. We knew how to, you know, all of these different skill sets, but we didn't understand how to actually create wealth from that because we weren't taught entrepreneurship. We had a skill set, but having a skill set doesn't always equate to, you're a good business person, if that makes sense. And then you take that system that takes, you know what I'm saying, that stole our money. So that's a whole other conversation as well. So kind of going back into that. Oh, go ahead, Ted. I hear you coming in.
Well, I was just going to say there are plenty of really smart doctors and lawyers who are not good at running their business, even though they have a legal or medical practice. And that's actually more common than people can imagine.
Ted, I've been in my industry going on 2 decades. I've had a neurosurgeon who barely had $10,000 to his name, making $400,000 a year. And it's like, because to your point, formal education doesn't mean you know how to manage money, right? It doesn't.
Right.
And it's a reason why 70 to 80% of businesses fail. There are some people out here with phenomenal skill sets, phenomenal products, phenomenal offerings. Why are so many of these businesses failing? It's because of the lack of the financial intelligence. Because for you to be good in, I was a personal trainer at one point in time. When I was a school teacher and a coach before I moved to Columbus and got into the financial service piece. So as a personal trainer, your personal trainer is making really good money. But just because you have a personal training business that doesn't mean you know how to manage the money. And just because you're a doctor or lawyer, like I've seen doctors who are almost broke. And you're like, man, how's that possible? Just because you're making a lot of money doesn't mean that you're keeping a lot of money. And going to your point, that the first example I gave earlier, that client had the $900,000 with him, was a pharmacist. He owned a pharmacy.
Oh, wow.
Retired. Right. So this is a smart individual who burnt through every dime of his investments. So you're absolutely right. So we talked about ownership. So we talked about entrepreneurship. We talked about immunity post-slavery. So something else that you'll pick up in this this documentary. One way wealth can be created is through the use of life insurance. So let's kind of talk about the Rockefellers a little bit, and then we'll get back to the whole boss piece. So we know the Rockefellers from creating their wealth through the oil industry, Standard Oil, like you said. But if you understand what happened to Standard Oil, they had a monopoly on that space, and the U.S. government came in and broke that business up. So that business was broke up. Well, how in the world are the Rockefellers still relevant right now and one of the richest families ever to be on the earth? Well, they use life insurance. And the way they use life insurance is something that you and I can do right now, Ted. So in a book, what's called What Would the Rockefellers Do? It talks about how the Rockefellers use life insurance to create a family trust and become their own self-sustaining economic system and created their own. So it worked like this, y'all, and this is something simple that we all can do. What they did was this. They created a family trust. That is a legal document that you can have an attorney write up for you, and they created just a Rockefeller Rockefeller Living Family Trust. Well, when the Rockefellers, they had life insurance on their lives. And let's say they had a $5 million life insurance on one of the lives. Well, when that person died, the life insurance paid into the living trust. So the trust was the beneficiary of the life insurance policy. And just note, and just as everybody's taking notes on here, life insurance, receive a life insurance payout, that's tax-free. That's not income, okay? So they got tax-free money that went into the trust. So now we got $5 million in the trust. Well, I come along, let's say I'm little Rockefeller Jr., and I'm like, hey, I know we got $5 million in the trust. Can I get some money out? The Rockefeller said, nah, you just can't walk up here and just get money out the trust. What you can do is you can actually take a loan out for, you know, a couple hundred dollars to fund your business. So we're going to do a loan with you. So you're going to have a loan that you need to pay back with interest. And we're going to put life insurance on your life and make the trust as the beneficiary. Well, if you have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people doing this, this trust keeps getting funded with more tax-free money. Now you may have $1 billion in this account, and the family now can always go to this trust and access the funds in a form of a loan. So now the trust making income is being funded with tax-free money, and you're passed down. I was having this conversation earlier on. My wife, before we got married, we got $1 million policy with her. She's paying $47 for $1 million term life policy. And now, because we're now married and I have children from this relationship, I want to make sure that my daughters are taken care of. So now we establish a living trust, and the trust is the beneficiary. So if something were to happen to my wife and I, $2 million would go into that trust, and the trust is written in such a way that it pays out to them. If my daughters are still minors at that time, it pays out to them a certain way, right? But now we've created that wealth, and now my daughter's going to be required to do the same thing so that they now have funds they can pass on to their kids. So it's a simple strategy that we all can do, but that's why the Rockefellers are still relevant, because their industry was broken up. They're not in the oil industry the way they are. Right. That industry was broken up. So now, going back to post-Civil War era, one of the easiest ways to create wealth is through life insurance. Well, again, the same situation that happened to us with the banks. And let me kind of set it to start this way. It amazes me when I talk to our folks and they say, oh, man, I can't afford life insurance. Life insurance is expensive. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Life insurance is expensive. If you get it when you're young and you're healthy, again, my wife got $1 million policy when she was 35 years old for $47 a month. And that's a 20-year policy. So for the next 20 years, she's paying $47 a month. We spend $47 a month in our first 10 minutes at the restaurant. Right. So are you kidding me? So it's affordable, but I hear our people say all the time, man, you know, life insurance is expensive. And I'm like, thinking to myself as a financial advisor, why do my folks struggle with this? Why I see GoFundMes on Facebook and social media, so-and-so died, and man, we just need help to bury them. Are you kidding me? Life insurance is not expensive. So I've always struggled, like, how in the world are we walking around with no life insurance? Well, we go back to this documentary. We not only were putting monies into the banks, but we were being educated and saying, hey, you need to have life insurance. You need to have life insurance. Well, this is what happened systematically. It was an article written, because we didn't have social media and it wasn't the news channels back then, but it was an article written in a newspaper that said black folks die a lot sooner than white folks. Right. But anybody who understands, because and I believe the article said it's because of the way our kids were shaped that we were going to die a lot sooner than white people. Well, here's the difference. If you understand insurance, if your insurance rate is based upon how long you're projected to live. Right. It's based upon your health. So if I'm projected to live till 80 and you're projected to live till 50 and we get insurance at the same time, your policy is going to be more because it's a chance you're going to die and I'm going to have to pay out. So the insurance company looks at that risk, and that's how they determine how much you're going to pay. Well, when this article came out, immediately all the insurance companies said, if these black folks want insurance, we're going to charge 100, 200, 300% more than we're going to charge the white people. So back then, that's what was passed down. Insurance is expensive. We can't get insurance.
Right.
Right. So we can't get insurance because it's expensive. It's not. But
when
they
you
made
combine
it
that,
you
combine that with Freedman's Bank, so now you don't trust banks, and you the insurance is you're getting taken. You're paying more for than what a non-black would pay. So it's
absolutely.
Partly trust also, like feeling deceived.
Yeah.
You're going to charge me more for it because I'm black, so I'm not going to bother.
And they might not pay out. We ran into that situation a lot too then. So anybody know Malcolm X's story? When Malcolm X, dad, the pastor, was murdered, and they laid him on a train track and his hit, you know what I'm saying, after they beat him and laid him on a train track to ran over by a train, his wife went in to collect on the insurance policy, and they said, well, nope, we can't pay you because your husband committed suicide. She like, what you mean committed suicide? They beat him and threw him on the train track. Well, he committed suicide, and we don't pay out insurance policies on suicide. So how many times did that happen where, oh, well, you know what I'm saying, he was lent, whatever the case may be. So now with the ones who actually could go and afford insurance, they weren't being paid out. So what do you think the conversation is at the kitchen table in the black household? Don't trust the bank.
Right.
Steal your money. We can't afford insurance because they make it too expensive
right.
for us. And it's a chance that we could pay for it. And when we go to collect on it, you know, Judy, they won't give us our money anyway. So why even do it? So
right.
now, oh my God, the tools we need to create wealth have pretty much been systematically taken away from us. And unfortunately, the same way we pass down recipes, you know, how to make collard greens and we still making chitlins in 2019 because that's what was passed down from generation to generation. Well, guess what? The
right.
mindset on money and creating wealth was passed down as well. So I run into situations where I'm dealing with people who are making very good money, but it's like, I'm afraid to invest because I don't want nobody to steal my money, or I don't get any life insurance. You know, life insurance is a scam. Well, it was because systematically that was in place, but we're not dealing with that now. But we are still using those same lessons that were taught to from the late 1800s, early 1900s here in 2019.
And that creates a mindset, and mindset will shape your behavior and your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's invisible. You just accept it. When you talk about recipes, it reminded me of a story. A husband and wife. The wife is about to. She's cooking a ham, and she's about to put it into a pan, and roast it. So the wife cuts off one end of the hand, she cuts off part of it and then cuts off the other hand, drops it in, and her husband says, well, honey, why do you cut off two ends of the ham? And she said, well, I don't know. That's the way my mother, she always did that. And he said, well, why don't you ask her? Why do you do that? And so she said, okay, good idea. She calls her mother, Mom, why do you cut off two ends of the ham? And she said, I don't know. That's what my mother did. And lucky, her mother was still alive. So she calls her mother. And her mother, Mom, you know, why do you cut off both ends of the ham? She said, well, I raised you during the time of the Depression, and we couldn't afford a big enough pan for the ham. So in order to fit it in, I had to cut off both ends of the ham and put it in. That's why I did it.
Wow.
And meanwhile, that just gets passed down, and the granddaughter has no idea that that's the relationship with cutting off both ends of the hand. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Man, if our viewers don't take anything else away from our conversation, that right there is so powerful. If the way you're handling your money, is it something, the way we handle money is something that is taught to us. Period.
Correct.
Right? How we do, and if we're still using a strategy that was relevant during the Great Depression in today's times, we're using the wrong strategy. That strategy doesn't apply now. But if we don't go out there and have transparent conversations and go out there and seek help and get education and understanding and build relationships with financial experts who can kind of guide us and help us, you know, look at those, identify those blind spots, we're still using a strategy from the late 1800s in 2019.
Correct.
I mean, brother, you
Correct.
Hit that. You hit that. Now, I love that story. I'm going to use that in one of my next presentations. That's amazing.
So you know, before you go on, I want to still talk about a little bit of insurance. You and I talked about this. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are people who say, can't send my children. We're never going to have money for college.
Mm-hmm.
And college isn't always the answer, right? Because mm-hmm. there are people who are crane operators, and they make anywhere – they make $300,000 to $400,000 a year as a crane
mm-hmm.
operator. It's very
mm-hmm.
specialized, and some people may say, well, they won't let me in. Well, yeah, so that's one way to look at it, right? So so you can send your children off to college to be engineers and architects and doctors. There are trade schools. There are plumbers who make, and I'm sure you've seen this, like there are plumbers who make really good money, electricians.
Mm-hmm.
Carpenters, I know someone who, you know, their family, they are all carpenters and brick masons and electricians. It's like the whole family has some trade that they actually can create a very holistic business in developing real estate, building real estate, because they have all the skills right in the family. And you can create a very lucrative business, especially if you have starting it with family as your base.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to pay for college or a trade school,
mm-hmm.
talk about ways that you can use an insurance policy. We've discussed it on our show before, but I want people to have full confidence in how this works. So
uh-huh.
is there a way that when that child is born, you can take out an insurance policy that supports higher education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So two things I got to address on this one, Ted, because you're dropping gems on our listeners and they may not even realize it. So I got to address what you said at the very beginning of our segment. And you just said it. You alluded to it right here. People,
okay.
understand this. Your family is the most important corporation you will ever be a part of. Those families who run their, those individuals who run their family like a corporation with all the checks and balances, understanding the cash flow, understanding the debt, understanding the credit, understanding the skill set of the other family members and how we can use that to create income and eventually create wealth are the families that win. That's why I'm so big on teaching entrepreneurship, because even if you have a 9-to-5, you still need to understand entrepreneurship. Because in your household, whether you're a household of one or a household of 15, that is the most important corporation you'll ever be a part of. So I just have to say that because you brought it up twice now. Now, going back to your question about
insurance. And your two most important people are the co-founders, your mother and your father. They are the partners.
Now, that is the CEO and the COO. Right? So the dad
Correct.
Is the CEO. This is the vision of the tech family. And we can, and man, we good at vision, but we sure ain't good at detail. So you having the right woman with you can give us all, like the right woman can make all the difference. So that's your chief operating officer, and she keeps everything moving and puts all the systems in place. Absolutely correct. Or even vice versa, because it doesn't have to be based upon the sex. But to your point, that man and woman is the CEO and the CEO. For sure, without a shadow of a doubt. And that's another reason, again, that we're falling behind on this whole wealth creation piece, because we have these broken homes and we don't have a CEO in there making all the decisions on their own, or the CEO making all the decisions on their own, but we have that complementing piece to be able to take us to the next level. But we can talk about that a whole other segment. But going back to your question about the insurance. So let me say this to everybody. I am what you call a fully licensed financial advisor. And I don't like to use the word financial advisor anymore. We've adopted the fractional CFO piece. I think it's more relevant to how we help our clients. I'm licensed to do stocks, bonds, investments, retirement plans, and insurance. So I'm not just a person who's going to just shove insurance down your throat. I believe that you need to have a financial plan before you do anything, because your financial plan is your blueprint to creating wealth. Okay. So if we were going out, Ted, and we're going to build our dream home, we wouldn't go out and start buying furniture before we had the architect do the drawings. And that's unfortunately what a lot of us do. So before I get this recommendation on how you can use insurance to help with college, understand, you know, invest in anything until you have a financial plan. Your first investment should be the financial plan. It should not be term, whole life, stocks, mutual funds, 401k. It should be the financial plan. If we're so again, we've been in our dream home. How idiotic or backwards does it look if we're building our dream home and we say, hey, Ted, okay, about to build our dream home over here on the west side of Columbus. Okay, and then okay, so what we need to do first? Well, shoot, man, let's go to Home Goods, you know what I'm saying, and start buying some stuff, and let's go to Best Buy and get big screen TVs, and then we take our big screen TVs and we go to the plot of land where we're gonna build a house. Folks will be like, what are y'all doing? Y'all look, we're building a house. What you got the TV for? We're gonna put this in the house. Well, where are you gonna put it? Well, we don't know. We built the house. That's how people, when they invest without having a financial plan, they look crazy. So you build, get the financial plan, and you get those architectural drawings, then pick investments is easy because now the home is built. Because now you plan and said, okay, how many bedrooms do you want? Four bedrooms, three baths. We want, we want 5,000 square feet. We need two garages. We want a basketball hoop. You know what I'm saying? We want a bathroom downstairs so my mom don't have to climb the stairs. You do that first, then you start investing. So now to kind of set that expectation, let's go into this strategy. Because strategies are not financial plans. Understand that, Joe. A strategy, and this is what we're talking about right now, a financial plan, this right here is a piece of furniture that goes into your wealth-building home. So start with the plan first. Go on to the strategy, though. So, yes, we talk about insurance as a vehicle that can help us out. What some savvy individuals do, and it's because it's based upon their plan. When they have their children, after your child is a couple months old, so you can't do it like the day born, but after a couple months old, and it may vary with different insurance companies, but let's say 18 months or something along those lines, they'll take out an insurance policy on the child. And I know people say, like, ooh, I don't take no insurance policy on no child because I don't think that my baby's going to die. And get over that mindset. That is not a wealth-building mindset. We're not taking a policy out because we think the child is going to pass away, because God forbid, we don't want any young children passing away. But you can take out a whole lot of cash value policy for that child in their name, where the policy is on their life, but you as the parent are the owner of that policy. And as you're funding that policy is accruing cash value. Come time for a little junior or a little Bridget to go to college, you can now access the cash value of that policy that they've had since they've been 1 or 2 years old. So we've had 16, 17 years of growth in that policy. And keep in mind, when money is growing inside that whole life insurance policy, it's just a standard vanilla whole life. It's not subject to market fluctuations. So it's constant growth. And dealing with a strong company that's paying dividends inside of it, you may be looking at a significant nest egg. So let's say that a little Johnny now is 18 years old, about to go to college now, and you have, let's say, $50,000 inside this insurance policy that they passed since they were born. Hey, little Johnny, you want to go to school? I want to go to Howard University. That's actually where I started. That's actually, Ted, that's where I started school, was at Howard. And then I had the coach recruiting to play basketball left, and that's how I ended up in Genesee and New York. That's not the story. But, okay, I want to go to Howard, right? Well, you can access the money from that insurance policy. And when you take the money out of that cash value whole life insurance policy, if you take it out in the form of a quote-unquote loan, that money comes out tax-free. You may think like, well, a loan, Perry, don't you have to pay a loan back? Technically, you do. But a cash value policy, if it's with a strong insurance company, is generating a dividend. So you may have been already, or may have already reached a point where you didn't pay anything else into it, and it's generating a dividend on its own. So the dividend by that cash value policy may be able to pay the loan. So now you're taking the money out tax-free as a loan because, hey, y'all, you don't pay taxes on loans. It's a cash-out refi on your house. You don't pay taxes on that cash-out refi because it's a loan. You're taking a loan out of this policy. It comes out tax-free, and depending on how the policy structure, it may be a position to actually pay the loan off. So now you technically just got tax-free money. Not only can you do this for college education, but for wealthy individuals, and y'all understanding what that means, think with the end in mind. I start off at about $100 a month. How about we reverse engineer into what the they do, and then apply it to our own personal situation. I was sharing this earlier. A lot of doctors who use this type of strategy to fund their retirement. Because these dollars, they can put away way more money into these type of products than they can into a 401k. And those monies come out tax-free. So that's the deal. So I'm glad you brought that up just to kind of share that as a strategy. This is a strategy, y'all. I'm not a financial man, but this strategy can be used to not only fund college, but could be part of your retirement plan.
Or you could use it. Your child, the same child, could use it to buy their first home, or they could use it to even invest. And you and I talked about just hypothetically. Let's say it's $20,000. They cash out of the insurance policy and they invest that money. And within let's say 18 months, that $20,000 is now $40,000. There, as an affluent person, I just doubled my $20,000. I have $40,000. I could actually, and we talked about capital gains taxes, right? There are all kinds of ways that you can use that money. So I can pull that original $20,000 out and say that's my principal. That's from my insurance policy. So now I can't even be taxed on that $20,000. If I have a really good accountant, he's going to help me that where I don't pay, I pull $20,000 out without paying taxes, and I still have $20,000 in there that's either it's in a stock paying dividends or it's in Bitcoin, right? It could be in Bitcoin. It could be in anything. And it could be paying dividends and still appreciating in value if I bought a stock of IBM, it's now, you know, that stock price is going up or it's split or whatever happens. So
let me jump in real quick on that one, Ted. So here's the deal, folks. If you work a job, right? So any of our listeners in here, if you work a job, what is your tax rate at your job? Your tax rate at your job, and it's based on how much money you make, but, you know, it could be as high as 40 or maybe even higher. But, you know what I'm saying, you're probably paying 15, 20, 25, 30% of what you earn is going to taxes. Let that sink in for a second. 20 to 40% of everything you generate is going to taxes. Your tax bill is your largest bill. It ain't your mortgage. It's your tax. It's your tax bill, right?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So you need to understand how affluent individuals manage their taxes. I heard, you know what I'm saying? So I remember our current president was running for office, and you know, we're up in arms because we ain't seen his tax returns, but we know, you know what I'm saying, Cass is mad, like he ain't paid taxes in so many years and da 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 da. And what was going on in his tax return, he had what was called an NOL. It's called a net operating loss because he's in real estate. Well, if y'all understand taxes, and if you don't understand taxes, you work with somebody who does. When you have a loss on a real estate transaction, okay, and you claim that as a loss, that is a loss you can put on your taxes that never runs out. Well, I'm gonna say never runs out. It doesn't expire. So let's say I had a real estate transaction and I lost $400,000. Okay, it's like, man, I took a bath on this thing. Well, the unsavvy person that doesn't have any members of their financial team and they're making decisions on their own are going to be like, shoot, this is bad. I lost it. House foreclosed, bad deal, whatever. I'm just going to walk away from it, right? Well, the savvy person or the smart person is going to say, let me speak to some experts and see what my options are. Oh, I can use that as a loss of my taxes. Okay. Well, how does that work? Well, let's say I make $50,000 the next year, but I have a $400,000 operating loss. That NOL is applied to my income, which means I made $0 that year. My income or adjusted gross income is negative $350,000. Well, how much taxes do you pay on zero income, people? Nothing.
Right.
So again, don't be mad at what the affluent is doing. Learn how to do it. You don't have to be a Donald Trump and a billionaire to take advantage of an NOL. You can do that, you know what I'm saying, making $20,000 a year. Understand the strategies. Don't be mad at the strategies you're doing. I hear this too, where people be like, oh, Perry, these CEOs are paying less in taxes than the people who are working. It's just not fair. Well, find out how to use it in your life. Yep, you just said that your household is the most important corporation you could be a part of. How can you use that same strategy? The reason CEOs are paying less in taxes is because they like, you know what, give me my little salary, but I want you to give me the bulk of my money in stock. Why do they do that, period?
Right.
Well, here's the deal. Income is taxed at whatever that marginal tax rate is, so 30, 40%. But when you get a stock and you hold on to it for a year and then you cash it out, that's taxed at capital gains, which is a max of 20%. So you're talking about 15 to 20%, not less. So they like, pay me in stock, not in income. Well, you can use that same strategy for yourself. So going right. back to what you were saying earlier, how do you leverage those strategies? Because your tax bill is going to be one of your largest bills. Imagine, y'all, if you put 30% of your money back on your paycheck. Imagine if you looked at your pay stub right now and everything that came out, minus you on your healthcare stuff, but like your taxes, was back onto your paycheck. What does that look like? And I'll share this with the,
right.
the audience too. There's a book that I use as part of my financial planning strategy with all of my clients. It's called The Power of Zero, How to Get to the 0% Tax Bracket in Retirement.
Wow. Wow.
And what
wow.
are they using? They're using life insurance and Roth IRAs and Roth 401ks, because the wealthy know, shoot, if I put that 30% back in my pocket, I don't need to save that much money. I just gave myself a 30% raise by understanding.
Exactly.
Right? So, yeah. So to your point, absolutely. Yep.
Hey, Perry, one second. I let's see if we can – we have some people who have called in. So for those who would like to ask Perry some questions, you can call in at 323-642-1387. That's 323-642-1387. Let's see if someone has a question for you. I'm going to take area code 570. 570, you're live and on the air with Straight Talk. What's your name and where you calling from? Good evening. You're breaking up. Who's calling and where are you calling from? All right. Well, maybe they didn't speak. I guess 570, you just want to listen or did you have a question? Okay. They're going to listen, Perry.
No worries. Good stuff. Good
some people are enjoying the jewels you're dropping, so they just want to suck it up and take it in.
Oh, it's all good. It's all good.
So go ahead. You're on strategy. So we laid out some things, some what some people may call exotic strategies for life insurance life insurance.
So we talked about the life insurance. So again,
policy.
That's some strategies you can use. We talked about tax management. Those are also some strategies that we can use. We talked about entrepreneurship. So recently gave a presentation. I'm a standing presenter for the Ohio Society of CPAs, and I also fly around the country. I've spoken at the AICPA National Convention, and one of the things that we talked about, entrepreneurship and how to manage the cash flow. So entrepreneurship is hot right now. Everybody and their mama want to start their own business, right? And it's for just cause. One, that's something that you can own. Nobody can ever take away your skill set. So if you start a business based upon your skill set, that's something that you own. But this is a stat I saw, I think it was an article in 2016. It said, as of 2016, entrepreneurship is the leading driver of wealth creation in the United States as of 2016. Ted, before 2016, the leading driver or indicator of wealth in the United States was legacy, was inheritance. So let that sink in for a second.
It was inheritance.
Yes.
Interesting.
The leading indicator of wealth was what you got from mom and them, granddad and them, big mom and them. That's the leading indicator of wealth up until 2016. So just to tie all of this together, if you, when my parents pass away, I'm not receive anything, right? So I'm just happy to have a decent policy in place where we can hear some folks and not have to pass the hat, or, well, that's about folks from down south got to pass the hat, right? So
right.
At least we have to worry about that. But I'm not going to receive $1 million. I'm not going to receive $100,000. I'm not going to receive $10,000. We have just enough money to bear. So, but the leading indicator, leading driver, wealth up until 2016, inheritance. Well, how do you create inheritance? Life insurance, owning real estate,
right.
What you pass down, right? So, but now, you know, I can have a spilled milk, right? My parents weren't privy to this information that I'm sharing right now. Had they been, they would probably be multimillionaires because they were super hardworking people, but they had no financial strategies and or systems. So I can't probably spill milk and be like, oh man, my mom and dad ain't going to be done. No, it's my job to create the wealth and create the legacy for the future generations, right? Well, entrepreneurship is the leading indicator, leading driver of wealth, which means that if you get entrepreneurship, whether it's a side hustle, or hustle, that right there can allow us to close the wealth gap. But we got to get it right. So think about this. If that's the leading driver of wealth, but the stats also say, excuse me, that 70 to 80% of businesses fail. Well, if we know we got to add this entrepreneurship piece to what we're doing to make up for hundreds of years of not being able to create wealth and not receiving any inheritance and things of that nature, but we know we can close that gap with entrepreneurship and go out here and create a business that paying us, you know, an extra $50,000 a year or extra $100,000 a year, or maybe it's paying you seven figures a year, like some of my clients. Well, we got to get that. We got to get that part right. And entrepreneurship isn't just, hey, I got a good idea. Again, you're the CEO of the company. Who's your CFO? How are those dollars being managed when they're coming in? Do you have the right financial systems? So if 70 to 80% of businesses fail, why are they failing? A lot of times people always want to point to, all my marketing is, I need more marketing, I need more ads, I need more people to buy my stuff, and blah, blah, blah. I've worked, Ted, with clients from, honestly, East Coast to West Coast, all the way out in D.C. and Virginia, all the way to California and Vegas. I've worked with entrepreneurs who are doing $100,000 a year, and I work with entrepreneurs who are doing $1.3 million a year. And this is the common thing I see with all of them. They do not understand fully their numbers with their business. They have no financial systems in place. And just because you tell me you're doing $1.3 million a year, that don't mean that's what you're making. That don't mean that's how much profit you have. That just means what you generated. I had a client who was doing $800 a year. He was paying out almost $900,000. Bro, you're bankrupt. Your business, like your profit and loss statement says negative. So again, understanding is just about starting a business is having the right systems that you can actually create more, some financial independence, become financially independent, and then create some wealth. Because now if that business is profitable and cash flowing the way it needs to, and then you add these other strategies with dealing with your taxes and your investments and real estate and all of that, now we close that gap on wealth.
So two things. The one is taking in what we talked about earlier, that lawyers and doctors are not always the best business people. I read a case study about a law firm doing $450 million a year. This is a huge law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And one day the employees showed up and there were padlocks on the door because they went bankrupt. They were out of
mm-hmm.
business. So they might have been making $450 million, but they might have been spending $500 million and they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave no warning.
Mm-hmm.
So when you put in the system, what do you call it? Like rolling profitability? It's possible now. There's enough technology and tools out there to know if you're profitable on a daily basis. Do you get to that with your clients at all? Okay.
Yeah. So it's a great segue. I know you didn't do this on purpose, but this is a great segue to kind of introduce my past program.
Before you go down that path,
mm-hmm.
is there a reason you didn't say a house was the best investment you could make?
So, yes. Okay. This may not
be. Or is that going to take us too far? Is that going to take us too far off?
Oh, no. We're going to tie this back in. This is perfectly fine. So,
okay.
In my world, and again, this is Perry's philosophy, this is the gospel. But in Perry's philosophy, I don't view home as an investment. And let me tell you why. So investment, by definition, is you taking your cash, or you can reinvest in time, or you're taking some resource and you're putting it into something else that is going to get you a ROI, return on investment. So case in point, if you give me $100 and in 2 months I give you $200, you made $100. So you doubled your money, which means your ROI, return on investment, is 100%. Okay. Well, when you have a home, and I'm not saying don't have home ownership. I'm saying let's talk about what an investment is. When you have a home, and let's say you have a 30-year mortgage on it, you could quite possibly, on your interest rate, put in $350,000 over the 30 years to get that $100,000, to pay off that $100,000 loan, right? So let that sink in for a second. You're paying $350,000 to possibly have $100,000 in it. Well, and that's just saying that the home didn't appreciate. Well, let's fast forward and you say, well, I got this great investment. It's my home. Okay, great. So can you use that investment to go out and, you know, make more money? How do you get an ROI on that? Because right now you don't have an ROI on that. You're hoping it goes up in value, but there's no ROI because you may have paid more into it than what the return on investment is as far as the appreciation. So let's say, and I had this conversation with my CPAs here a week or so ago. Okay, so you paid your home off. I'm happy for it. It's outstanding. Great. But you're thinking about your home as an investment. Well, you went to now your home to now go buy another home or go, you know, whatever the case may be. Well, how do you get your money out of your home? You don't have a faucet home where you go to and be like, right, my faucet home and get cash out. You actually need to get money out of your home. You got a couple options. One, you can sell it and hope that there is good market it is right now and get your money out, right? But you don't want to sell your home because where you live. So maybe that's not the best option. So let's say the next option is, well, hey, here, I can borrow against it. Great. Let's start right there. For you to take money out of your home to be able to use those dollars to go get an ROI someplace else, you can't just go to the bank and be like, hey, bank, man, shoot, my home is off and I know it's worth $200,000. I need you to give me $250,000, but I need you to give me $200,000 right now because I'm going to go buy some XYZ. I'm going to go start my business. But a bank will look at you and be like, well, what's your credit? What's your debt to income ratio? Oh, you just quit your job. Oh, you can't take this money out. I have a client right now who has $250,000 of equity sitting in his home right now. And he worked for corporate America. Like me, he got tired of corporate America. He started his business. And then I was actually talking to him one day, and he was like, how's things going? He's like, man, my cash flow is tight, and I don't have any working lines of credit. And he was like, man, and I got $2,000 of loan. I said, so what's the issue? Well, I just started my own business, and I'm not showing any profits in the business yet. Also, he got some, and we'll get back to the systems office, but I'm not showing any profits in it. So the bank won't give me a loan to get my own money out of my house. So I don't think of the home as an investment. I think of a home as that's your home because and that's just how I kind of view it. So, you know, depending on who you're talking to, they could argue that. But again, if I can't take that asset and go get an ROI that I can calculate, I don't consider it an investment.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And your point is, if you take a 30-year mortgage and pay it off in 30 years, you've paid at minimally about three times the original purchasing price. So,
yep.
$100,000 home, you paid $300,000. That's not counting maintenance and all the other things that, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
So you haven't really made any – there is – you created an opportunity cost that you could have done something better with your money.
Chad, I have a client who's a dentist. He makes me one day say, oh, parent, so we sold the house. We're about to sell the house. We're selling the house, and I got $40,000 in equity. You know what I'm saying? I got $40,000 from the sale, and I'm putting that on the new house. Man, that's pretty good, man. I was only in the house less than 10 years and got $40,000 out. So he's just super excited about it. I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, well, Perry, you don't sound excited about it. I said, well, let me ask you this. What's your monthly payment over the past couple years? And I don't numbers directly in front of me, but let's just say he was paying $2,000 a month for the home, okay? So $2,000 a month for the home is what he was paying. 2,000 times 12, so he's paying $24,000 a year. $24,000 a year over the past 10 years, he's put $240,000 into, right? If my math is correct. So I said, so let me ask you a question. If you gave me $240,000 now, and in 10 years, I gave you a statement that said, hey, it's worth $40,000. Congratulations. Would you call that a good investment or not? And he was like, wow. So again, listeners, I'm not saying that your home, I'm not saying that real estate is not a good investment, because I do believe that real estate, especially rental properties and buildings and franchises and all of that, are absolutely investment. But your home is not an investment. So going back to, go ahead.
Well, unless I have a buddy who bought, I think it's a 6 or 8 unit building, and he just took the entire top, like each floor has 2 units, and he just took the entire top floor, like 2,000 square feet. Except he's collecting rent. He has a rent roll, so and
exactly.
It's his mortgage, and he can have a part time job and still live. Plus. Well, the appreciation, which doesn't mean anything, because if he has a part-time job, he can't get the equity out of it, or he would have a difficult time unless
Correct.
He shows significant numbers in his rent roll. So,
absolutely.
But that's more of an investment right there. If you have rental property.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what I'm saying? One of the best investments I've made is when I bought my first unit and I lived in one of the units, and I looked at that property as, okay, I live here, but it is now. This is an investment because, to your point, the rent's covering all the debt service, right?
Right.
So it's like, okay, there's a rate of return on this. I put in whatever it was, $10,000-$20,000 and just buy it on the down payment, and this is what I'm getting off of that $10,000-$20,000 return on investment. These rents I'm collecting, and then I'm using those rents to pay this off. So yeah, in that case scenario, yeah. But if it's a single family home, I wouldn't consider it an investment.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I think a lot of people misunderstand that. Yeah.
So going to kind of the piece you asked about, the entrepreneurship and the profitability. Here's what we've done, and I know our time is getting short, so I'll be super brief. We have a program, as you mentioned in my bio, called the PASS program. It's the Profit Accelerator Small Business System. This is what we know as absolute fact. Most entrepreneurs, reading 70-80% are failing, don't understand their numbers. Right. And also, too, maybe they're not savvy, or not, I won't say necessarily savvy, because half the time I didn't understand the numbers that the accountant was talking about until I just asked the questions. So maybe, you don't want to be a financial expert, because, again, most entrepreneurs aren't CFOs. Well, we created what's called our PASS program, which is an 8-step process that you do not have to be a financial expert to go through, which walks you through everything you need at the very onset of creating the financial systems to the very end, to how to make them, without having to go and look at accounting software, without having to go and look at QuickBooks. Those are things that your accountant can deal with, but as a CEO or a small business owner, you need to have access to data that allows you to make strategic decisions, so you know when to spend,
right,
where to spend, how to spend, the whole nine. So that's what we've done with our PASS program. And for anybody who goes to our website, perryjeffries.com, we actually give it all away for free. We have a no-cost training.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, because here's the deal. My goal is to be relevant in this world, Ted. And for me to be relevant, anybody who's following me know that I say, you can either be successful or you can be relevant. Successful is what you accomplish personally. Relevant is based on how many people you help become successful. So I give away the entire program. I give the whole 8-step process. Now, after you watch the training, you may go out and maybe do some things on your own, or you may say, you know what, this is phenomenal, but I still need to bring in that accountability partner, that master, because you may need somebody to help you, tell you to turn left when you should turn right, whatever the case may be. If you go to my website right now, perryjeffries.com, you'll see pop right up, hey, this is training. You can watch the training. There's no, we don't say, hey, work with this. You can say it's garbage. You can say it's the best thing ever. Nonetheless, we know it's just super, super valuable, because it's the information that I wish I had when I first became an entrepreneur back in 2001. And if I had this information and this system in place in 2001, undoubtedly I will be a multimillionaire and I want $1 billion today with this system. So this is the system we install for all of our clients who work one-on-one with us. What we've done now is realize everybody may not be able to afford to pay us to work one-on-one with us. We are totally fine with that. So that will be created the path online membership. So now you're a member of our online community, access to strategy we use with our clients to generate success. You have access to all of our works and the whole nine. So go watch the free video. Please give us your feedback on it. And if you want to come aboard as a member, become a member of the PAS program, you know, all that information is at the end of the video, but you can always reach out to me as well. So just a real quick plug, but the big thing is, y'all, it's free. And what I've done is taken my 30 years of combined experience as a financial advisor, as an entrepreneur, as a real estate investor, and I have got down to 8 steps that you can do today to ensure you make increase your revenue and your profitability. And that's kind of going into what you talked about, Ted. It's like, oh, so what can you use to kind of track profitability? Best way to track it, if your business is profitable, you should have that money in cash. Period. Point.
Right.
So you want to know how to track profitability? Show me your bank statement. If you don't, if there's no cash, your business ain't profitable. Right. So we make sure that when our clients say, hey, we had $20,000 in profit for the year, that's because I can show you $20,000 in a bank account. And we put that system in place for them.
Really good. Wow. Very good. So do you want to just tell people how they can how can they find it? Just give them the details just once again.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you just go to perryjeffries.com, that's PerryJeffries, Jeffries.com. Our website is super easy to follow. As soon as you go there, it's going to pop up. Do you want the free training? Yes, I want the free training. Click here. That's it. On that website, you'll be able to see some of our reviews and see some of our testimonials from some of our clients. You know, one client, we helped them save $2,000 a month within the first 15-minute conversation we had them. Another client, we found them $55,000 in tax deductions. Another client, several clients, we've got them, you know, upwards of $50,000 in working capital. A client that we just spoke today who's going to come on board, we're going to get her set up to where she can go and buy a building so she can launch her business. So, you know, we love creating success stories. And it's going to sound like a shameless plug. It's kind of just the timing of the event. We didn't time it this way. But and I'll extend this out to your viewers. I'm giving the program away after you watch the free training. If you want to get into the membership, I'm actually doing a 90% discount on the membership. So we're talking about for a couple hundred bucks, you get access to all this. Now, what you're going to have to do, you're going to have to connect with me someplace on social media and say, hey, Perry, let me get that 90% discount. You know, I was on Straight Talk with you and Ted, and I'm in because I'm going to shut that discount down tonight. But if you're on this podcast with us, I'll extend it to you for supporting Ted because this information and this platform, brother, is valuable. If I had heard something like this back in my early 20s when I first got into real estate and got this type of information, generational wealth, you know what I'm saying, would be an afterthought because, you know, I'll be a multimillionaire right now, right? But I didn't have this, even being a financial advisor. You know, I'm like, don't twist it. I'm not a rich guy by any way. I'm rich in knowledge, but I have to take a step back and hire some folks to identify my blind spots as well. And I've made some mistakes. My goal is for you not to make the mistakes I've made so we can close the gap, man. So go to perryjeffries.com, check it out, and then from there you can connect with us on either all our social media. But if you want that 90% discount, just hit me up and say, hey, I was on Straight Talk with Ted Santos. Love what you said. I want to be a member. We'll get you in there.
And then any of you who are connected to me on Facebook, Perry is connected to me on Facebook. You can find him through me as well. And if you have a challenge with that, just kind of inbox me and I'll connect you with Perry. And you can get that 90% discount. Just before we close out, what are your thoughts of Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I remember Bitcoin, it came out and everybody was losing their mind over Bitcoin. Perry, and I'm getting phone calls or emails or text messages from clients. Perry, do I need to get some Bitcoin? What you think? So here's the deal. I'm going to go back to what we said earlier about creating wealth. And for you to create wealth, you need to blueprint, because your wealth is a house that you're going to live in for the rest of your life. So we want to build the right house. So what my clients know is this: when we have our financial plan dictates where we put our money, period. So you got the right plan, or you got the right blueprint. The blueprint is going to tell you where to put the money. So when my clients came to me and said, "Perry, man, we're talking about this Bitcoin," I said, "Hey, here's the deal. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm just as confused about it as everybody else, and kind of understanding the whole blockchain piece and how companies are using it, and this may be the way of the future. But ultimately, this is an asset class that is brand new." Well, with a brand new asset class, in my mind, as a financial advisor, I'm going to tell my client, you know what? I'm not going to tell you not to invest in it, and I'm not going to tell you to, you know what I'm saying, put a bunch of money into it. But what I will tell you this: based upon your strategy, how does Bitcoin help you get closer to your end goal? Because again, we get so, especially our Black folks, we get so concerned about chasing the next shiny thing without understanding the basic principles of creating wealth. There's people out here who are creating, like Warren Buffett has created enormous amounts of wealth without Bitcoin. So first thing I'll be like, well, what is Warren Buffett doing, right? So with that being said, I told my clients, hey, let's put in, if you want to put some money in, let's do maybe 10 to 15% max of what you have in liquid assets. So if you got $100,000 in liquid assets, if we want to put $10,000 in it, $15,000 in it, again, let's do that. But we're not going to bet the house. We're not going to do the craziness that I saw where people are mortgaging their homes, because it's kind of like the same deal with cannabis. I don't think cannabis is going anywhere. I think, you know what I'm saying, at some point in time, it's going to be legal, you know what I'm saying, all over the place. Some states are already legal.
Right.
But the deal is, it's a very volatile asset class right now because it's brand new. We don't know what's going on with the brand new. Is it going to pull back? Is it going to go up? But do I feel like, you know what I'm saying, cannabis is going to be a CBD, it's going to be around for a long time? Absolutely it is. I kind of feel the same way about Bitcoin. It's a technology that multi-billion dollars and Fortune 500 companies are using. So, but again, it's a new asset class. So I would always ask my clients just to tell me how Bitcoin or cannabis, for that matter, if you're saying, hey, Perry, so-and-so said I need to buy an annuity, I'm going to ask you, well, how does that fit in their plan? And if you tell me you don't have a plan, that's going to be the first place to start. And if we have a plan, then we can find, because all the Bitcoin is furniture. After we have a plan, we can say, you know, we're going to put that in the den. that's going to be the big screen TV that we're going to put in the den, and that's where it goes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Perfect. Great advice. Any closing thoughts?
In closing thoughts, brother, I'll say this. Please keep doing what you're doing. And anytime you want to have me on to talk about different topics, I'll be happy to on, because information is so, so important. Let me say this in closing thoughts. Everybody, we have opinions. You have opinions. You have information. And you have advice. Opinions, you know, it's a saying out there about opinions. Hey, they're like so-and-so. They're like everybody has one, right?
Everyone has
so,
one, right?
Everybody has one. Well, here's the deal, y'all. Don't make life decisions or financial decisions or any decisions based on other people's opinions. Their opinions are formed from their experiences, not yours. Opinions. So if you want to just share your opinions, but don't make decisions off of that. So you have opinions, but then you have information. Information is based upon some type of factual data that can be proven, right? And that's what we've done this evening, is we've provided some information, right, to get you thinking outside the box, to get you thinking about wealth. That's information, and that's good stuff. But ultimately, you shouldn't be making decisions. The time you should be making decisions is based upon advice. And what advice is, we kind of classify it as this way. Advice is when an expert with a track record and results provides you with information that is specific to your need, not the need of, you know, your cousin now, mom and them, to your specific need. So when you find an expert with a proven track record, and again, when I say proven track record, if you can't show me where you've done it for yourself or you've done it for other individuals, you're not an expert. So with a proven track record of results, providing information specific to my individual needs, make your decisions on that. And what's so phenomenal about what Ted is doing with this podcast, especially bringing on experts, now you can give some expert information. Your friends may have told you X, Y, Z, oh, you should do this, you should do this. Well, if they're not an expert in that space, that's opinion. Now you're getting some information, and now you're thinking outside the box. Say the next step is make sure you find somebody that you want to work with who can give expert advice, and that's how you close this gap. And that's what I'll say, and to my friend, just keep doing what you're doing because it's super important. And we get information, expert information into our community and start building those relationships in that ecosystem.
Yeah, excellent. Great last thoughts. And, you know, you could say when you came on before, we started at kind of on the ground, right? Like in the weeds, financially fit. These are things that you do to become better at your finances. And now we stepped it up a few levels on this call. You know, we're at like 10,000 feet and talking bigger picture and strategy and planning. And we didn't even touch on it. Well, we got into the area when we started talking about family and your household being a corporation and the husband and wife and heading it together and the role they play. Family, you know, extended family outside of your immediate. And I think there's a conversation you and I can have that is more on a macro level and looking at not just resources of the individual skills, but some of the other resources that can be owned as a community and a kind of collaboration and cooperation that has to start at home that becomes part of the community and the kind of wealth that could be generated from that. And not losing sight of the fact that, yes, people are making money, except without ownership. And I'm not going to get into what that ownership looks like now, but you and I talked about the kinds of ownership that give you the kind of power to do the things that you want in your life and with your community. That's a bigger conversation than, you know, we just didn't even touch on that, and I'm glad we didn't, but I'm thinking that's a conversation you and I can have, and that's looking at how even some other companies or individuals or households can collaborate with one another to create greater economic power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. We got to start. So to your point, we started with big picture because, again, I believe we have to reverse engineer into every goal. So let's start off with big picture, defining wealth, what that is, ownership. Now that we define that, now we can have some of those more pointed conversations around, you know, strategies and how to execute. So I love the phone call, yet, and but that sounds like, Ted, that you're inviting me on for another segment, brother. So if that's the case, man, just let me know. I'm always down.
Okay. All right. So hey, big thank you for joining me. I love your time and your expertise. You're a huge and valuable asset to the community. Thank you for all the people who have called in and wanted to silently listen. Which that's a good sign because there are a number of people who called, and I think you just kind of have there's a captive audience there. They are just listening. For those of you who are interested in Perry's PASS program and the 90% discount, please don't hesitate to contact him, reach out. So thank you for the callers. Thank you for the listeners. Thank you for the Straight Talk family that's on Facebook, and I appreciate you all and your feedback. If you're not on our Facebook page, please connect with me, and I'll plug you into the Straight Talk Facebook page. And until next week, thank you all very much. Have a great evening, and thanks a lot, Perry, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you. Goodbye, everybody.
Take care. Bye.